Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson.
Well, hello, Susan, and hello to all our listeners out there.
I'm so glad you can be here with me today, Paul, because we're going to talk about innovation and farming with an entrepreneur from the Papa John Center at Iowa State and an entrepreneur whose business is helping beginning farmers get started.
Well, that sounds like something that could be pretty useful to a lot of folks out there today. It's going to be a great show.
And one of the programs in the second half of the show will be a follow-up on last week's story about solar energy.
Well, now I thought we covered that very thoroughly. You mean there's more?
Yes, we'll find what solar energy and football have in common.
Well, you're kidding. Where's the connection?
And you'll find out, nor am I kidding, when I say that we'll close out the program with a visit to the Nasty Women at Expressions Gallery in Slater.
Well, now let's get started. And we have guests in our studio today. We have Judy Isles, Assistant Director of the Papa John Center for Entrepreneurship, and Stephen Brockus, a recent graduate who recently has a year and a half's experience in the project that he developed through their programs. Welcome, Judy and Stephen.
Good morning.
Good. We'll start with Judy. Judy, how would you describe the Papa John Center to people who haven't heard before?
The first thing I guess I would say is we're not a pizza place.
That's good.
We're a center, one of five in the state of Iowa, named after John Papa John, lives in Des Moines, venture capitalist and a longtime entrepreneur. And our center was established 20 years ago to support students, faculty, staff, people in the community interested in pursuing a business opportunity. So we have a set of business programs, and we have a number of programs for students to provide experience and support as they pursue their ideas or businesses. Program that Stephen participated in, Size Starters.
Okay.
Students who have an idea, have a little traction, and we put them through a pretty rigorous 10-week program to help them learn the basics of getting their business launched, connecting with mentors, getting support, and then kind of pushing them along the way to be accountable for all the steps that they need to take to be successful.
Well, that's really very useful because someone has an idea, someone has a strong motive to get something accomplished, but they don't need to reinvent the wheel every time. You're giving them guidance about the steps to be taken, how to do that, pitfalls to avoid, and of course, right?
Of course, yep. There are a lot of people that we plug into the program who have sort of been there, done that, and those are folks that can share their failures, if you will, to help the next person be a little more successful in their process.
Now, do you recruit students for this program, or do they come to you?
Both. A lot of students don't recognize themselves as entrepreneurs, but they're doing something, and so helping them understand what entrepreneurship is and how those programs can support them. So we get a lot of people that just wander in with an idea, and then there are those who really, 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 really want to be in our programs.
So I'm a student who comes in, I've got a revolutionary idea, and I've got it all fleshed out. Do I present to you some sort of prospectus of what I'm planning to do?
The program in particular that Stephen was a part of, yes, each student was required to submit an application, and then we lined them all up one day in front of a bunch of very successful business folks and said, okay, pitch us your idea. So they did a formal presentation, and of those presentations, then we selected those that felt like they had merit to pursue the program.
That sounds like one of those TV shows where the prize goes to...
It is our own little shark tank, if you will.
It's not enough to comb your hair properly. You have to have some hard data and some things that go with trying to sell an idea, because beyond that incident there where you're making some connection about, you know, the people who are going to help you, eventually you're going to have to sell your idea all the way down the road as you're an entrepreneurial business person. So a profile, what sort of individual do you look for? What do they have to have as what you might say intrinsic things that they possess already as characteristics?
So first we'll look at the business concept. Is it viable? Is there the opportunity where, with our help, they can actually progress in that idea. And sometimes you don't really know that, and part of the process and part of the program is to help them discover that. But students who are enthusiastic, who work hard. Stephen is a model student participant.
Well, I have Steve here, so watch what you say.
No, it's absolutely true. Because there are obstacles and roadblocks inevitably that you have to work around. And so if you're a giver-upper, it's not a good path for you.
And how long has this been going on, that you're doing this sort of selective process and support for entrepreneurs? How far back does that go?
We've been supporting student entrepreneurs and campus entrepreneurs since for over 20 years. Prior to that, our Small Business Development Center, which is a partner of ours, we've been at this for 35 years. So the student piece is relatively new in the last 20 years. And the particular program that Stephen's a part of, this is just our second year.
Sounds fascinating because, number one, you have people here who are just at the beginning. Now, you're talking about undergraduate or graduates?
Both.
So both undergraduate and graduate students are eligible, and you're giving them an opportunity to not only expose their idea, but you're exposing it to people who can say, that will work, that may not work, here's what you need to do.
Absolutely.
So it's reality therapy.
It's
reality therapy. Now, did you personally work with Stephen?
Yeah. He was there every day, so every day there are people around that the students can ask questions of. I have to say Stephen is a pretty independent, resourceful, and he had a lot of traction before he came into our program, but absolutely, we saw him every day early in the morning, and then I'd come in late at night, and he was still there working.
Well, you sound pretty dedicated yourself, early in the morning and late at night. But, you know, that's the
entrepreneurial
hours that
life.
Entrepreneurs have, don't they?
Yep.
So I think that you're talking about, let's say you start with an undergraduate student. You'll work with them continuously, and they may or may not go to grad school, but at least until they graduate and beyond. Is that right?
And we have a number of programs. So the SciStarters, our summer program, is just one of them. But we do a lot of other programs. The students will kind of pick and choose the area, the speaker, the program that's of interest to them. And so we tend to see students, if they come in as freshmen, they kind of come in and out of the programs throughout their academic career.
Well, you probably had some exciting experiences. And would you mention maybe an example that you know about? We're going to talk with Stephen, but it's, you know, something that sticks out in your mind as a challenge, someone who was really outstanding, who really prospered.
I think of Nolan Herlocker, who is one of our students that I met as a freshman, lawn mowing business from back home. And since he's come in to our programs, he's been a leader in a number of things. He's now starting a drone business. He's probably had three or four different business opportunities that he's pursued. And it's that exposure, that meeting other people, thinking of new ideas. You just continue to explore because one idea isn't always the big hitter. And so you continue to find other new ideas based on the people you meet, the experience you have, the success or lack of success you might have in a business venture that you pursue.
Very interesting because, you know, you have an idea and you have a concept, but you also need a lot of things to go with that if you're truly an entrepreneur. And one of those has to be resiliency. They have to be resilient, don't they?
Absolutely.
Because there are going to be some setbacks. There are going to be some people who discourage you. There are going to be some things that are scary economically, you know, in terms of raising money, what might be happening in the farming community at large or in whatever business you're talking about, trends that are coming up, changes that are coming up. And so it's a very complex world that people get into at that time. And so they have to have certain personal characteristics. What would they be? If you look at a profile of a person who's likely to be successful as an entrepreneur, what would be some of the salient things, the things that are most obvious that they need to have as a character, let's say, you know, what they possess?
I think of being a salesperson, and you can't sell to everybody. There are a lot of people that say no. And that ability to hear no, to hear it's not a good idea, to hear that you really ought to do it differently, and to be able to brush that off and continue to focus, and not to be so bullish that you're determined that it's your way or the highway, but to be able to listen to the advice from other people that will help you, what we call pivot, as opposed to just being told no and walking away and saying, well, that's not a good idea, because there's just a lot of feedback you will get. And so having that ability to process what you hear, the advice you get, but be able to make a smart decision to keep moving forward despite the fact that not everybody's going to like your idea or believe in it.
Yeah, I think
so. That persistence is I think a really key factor in any entrepreneur.
Well, I once knew somebody who was in the direct mail business, you know. They said 2% is a great response. 2%.
Yeah, that's a lot of no's. That's a lot of no's.
I think that's probably a profile that exists across the whole conundrum here, because you've got anyone presenting an idea, especially if it's new, and especially if it might be revolutionary, or it might represent a different way of doing things that's been traditionally done in a different way. And so innovation is sometimes hard to sell because people might be skeptical of that, you know?
Absolutely.
So if you're innovative, it might be new, it might be scary, it might be a problem.
I've been listening very carefully to what you've been talking about, and I keep thinking about an old way of doing things. It used to be on the radio that people used to read in the morning programs from the newspaper. And this morning, I'd like to read from the Ames Tribune that was at our door this morning. It says, Ames-based farmland startup opens to the public. And this article is about Stephen Brockius.
Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing very well, especially when I get to the studio this morning and realize that Turva is on the paper.
It was fun to watch your face as you saw that you were, on the front page. That was fun to watch your response, because you didn't know that article was going to be out today, did you?
I talked with Dan yesterday at the Tribune. I didn't realize it was going to be up this morning, so that's pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, you know, we recently had a program on Local Talk with Neil Harrell and Teresa Oppheim, and they were talking about the issues facing farmers when they are ready to leave their farms or retire. It sounds as if you're coming to the problem from another direction, but it's still a huge issue. Steve, do you know the number of or the proportion of farmers who are at an age where they indeed might have to retire soon? What kind of numbers are we talking about there?
Yeah, great question. A majority of farmland owners throughout the country, especially in Iowa, are over the age of 65. I believe that number is just over 70%. And so within the next 5 to 8 years, we're going to see a majority of farmland exchanging hands and ownership to that next generation. And so there's a lot of land that'll be changing ownership. And I grew up on a fifth generation family dairy farm. And so we experienced that passing on of land from my great grandma to my grandfather and eventually down to my father and then, you know, my brothers and I. And I grew up on a dairy farm, and the barn that we milk out of is over 100 years old.
Oh, that's true of my farm. I have buildings that are just approaching. They'll be 100 on the year 2019. So
okay.
Birthday's coming up. So what you're talking about here is the trickiness, especially in the modern day, of that next generation. Now, mm-hmm. for a long period of time, all throughout Iowa, it was sort of a family tradition that you stayed on the farm, or at least one sibling did. Now, is that true in your case? Is there someone in your family who's going to continue to the next generation on the farm there?
Yes, I feel fairly lucky coming from this farming family. My grandma and grandpa are still working full-time on the farm, and my dad and uncle are partners in the operation as well. And so that farm is definitely staying in the family and continuing on, and we'll see which one of either myself or brothers picks it up, or I've got a lot of cousins as well who have interest. Everyone loves the farm and loves working on the farm, and so it's great to be able to come from a family that really does ring true.
Well, there's so many issues about this because, you know, if you have four siblings, let's say, in a case, I'm just throwing this case out as an example, it's right out of the air, but who's going to stay? And who's going to possess the farm? And the other three siblings who aren't going to remain, what's their role? It's very mm-hmm. complicated. Mm-hmm. I narrated a film for public television about Century Farms in Iowa, and it talked about the intricacies of passing the farm on mm-hmm. when there's more than one sibling, or in a case where no one wants to stay. And so then you have issues about do we retain the farm as a rental property with an ongoing income for the siblings, or do we sell, you know?
Yeah, there's a world of issues, especially when it comes to passing on land. And it's different than most any other asset because you do have that emotional tie to the land. And so it's hard to say that, hey, here's the set value because it might be different for different individuals, or trying to come up with a plan to make it fair and equitable moving forward is a huge challenge in agriculture. And we actually see in Iowa that more than 60% of farmland is rented out to other folks.
60%?
60%. So majority of land, and you'll see, you know, that might be land that's staying within the family, but, you know, those family members have moved away and the family wants to hold on to the farm. That's the wishes of the grandparents. And so you hold on to that land and you rent it out to great quality farmers in the area. But there's a lot of different issues that come around farmland. And that's what, you know, with Turbo, we aim to just tackle a few of those specific issues to try to help the ag industry.
Well, take us through the process you went through to create the program you have. You give us the name of it, first of all, mm-hmm. and how that evolved as an idea and what purpose that serves in the broad scheme of things, and then how this program at Papa John helped you. That's try and keep it under an hour.
I can get to talking. So, Turva is a website where farmland buyers and sellers can connect online. And so really it's like the introduction or a handshake that introduces folks so that they can either buy their land, sell their land, find more land to farm, or get connected with a ag real estate professional to help them, you know, get a loan on the land or understand as a beginning farmer, what do I need to do to qualify for the beginning farmer loan programs. And so it's really a place where folks can come to meet each other and feel more confident understanding the land industry. And the whole idea came about, I was actually at a land sale with my dad about 3 or 4 years ago up in northwest Iowa. And as I'm sitting there, I'm being the typical kid asking 1,000 questions. And, you know, he says, I'm asking, well, how do we know how much this land is worth and who's sitting in the room? And, you know, is it good quality land? Has it been taken care of? And so he said, well, go talk to your broker, Kevin Clausen, go talk to folks around. And so I started talking with people and realized that having access to information about not only individual parcels of land, but also what the current market trends are doing, it's a pretty difficult process to come by. And so putting my hat on as a young farmer and as someone looking at getting into farming, I decided, well, we should do something about this. And so I brought it up to Iowa State. I have a journal full of ideas, and I took a class of Kevin Kimley's in the Ag Entrepreneurship Initiative, and it's called Agriculture Entrepreneurship, Econ 334. So I jumped in that class, and I pulled out a couple of those ideas, and he challenges us to start talking with potential customers, try to actually sell your idea. And that's where, you know, Judy says, being a salesman is really important, and sometimes I don't like thinking of myself as a salesman, but really, you know, you're trying to sell people on this grand vision of the future all the time. And so I went out and talked with folks, and this is the idea that came to the top. And that was about a year and a half ago, and from there, fast forwarding to today, I've been able to be a part of a handful of startup programs. Size Starters is one of those programs. I'm part of the Startup Ames community that is here in the Ames area, a part of Venture School down in Des Moines through the University of Iowa. So there's a lot of different programs for entrepreneurs, and through that, I've been able to find connections to get developers to actually build the software. We've had clients who are testing the software, and the article that came out today is coinciding with our launch. We released our public software yesterday for folks to see what land is selling for and get connected with buyers and sellers. And so the entrepreneurial journey is an incredible one, exciting. There's a lot of high highs and low lows, and it's, you know, scary sometimes to not understand that clear future, but it's exciting to learn.
So at this point, you've got a website, that's right?
That is correct.
And so when people enter that website, increasingly they're going to have more and more information about what land's available, mm-hmm. what kind of things or opportunities are out there, current selling prices, mm-hmm. which probably would vary by area.
Yes, and that's a big thing because northwest Iowa, where I'm from, you know, land will be higher quality than it is in higher value than it is down in south central Iowa. And so knowing the different values at any given time for geographic areas is really important. But those values change over time. And so having timely information, we track every upcoming farmland sale, public sale in the state, and we alert people through our website. So if you're looking for land to buy or rent, you can get notifications right there. And then we also collect and track every land sale that has already happened and get prices for it so that pretty much the day that that auction closes, we have it up on our website and you can know, hey, what's the most real-time values of farmland.
So if someone goes on the website today, a lot of information available right now.
There is.
You put a lot of stuff together and that's been constantly increasing, changing, turnover updates that'll be current for the people coming to the website. As far as we go into the future, right?
That's correct. I've got an incredible team of individuals who are tracking and collecting this data, and so we actually update it on a weekly basis so that as close to real time as possible, we're letting people know what land values are doing. And that's a little different than it was done in the past. You know, I remember even being up at home and you ask, hey, what are land values doing? And someone be like, well, you know, John's farm down the road just sold for, you know, this many dollars per acre. And so you have one data point.
So it's hearsay, really.
And nobody, it's all conversations,
no,
you know.
Like they say, there's no hard data here.
Yeah. See, and that's what Turva brings to the table. We pull in the NRCS soil data, so we have a calculation of the quality of that land. We pull in, you know, tracking what the values of lands are doing in that area. We connect them with who's selling that land. And so we pull in, instead of the one data point, now you've got hundreds of data points over time, so you can start to see what are values doing and how does this fit into my operation. And that helps not only farmers who have been in it for a while, it helps landowners who are been in it for a while or are just getting in it. It helps land investors. And what I'm really excited about, too, it helps young farmers just trying to get their foot in the door as well.
And that's one thing that fascinates me, young farmers trying to get their foot in the door. There are people out there like that, and the capital investment and all the obstacles to that are pretty gigantic. So let's say I'm a young farmer, I get on your website, and that can be very helpful to me. It could be reality therapy, right? Because you're going to find out exactly what the farm values are. And also data for rental, is that correct? Like the rental of land? So, in a certain area?
So today we have farmland values on that sale transaction, and in the future we would love to be able to offer those rental prices and connect those individuals
as well. So that's one thing you're intending to incorporate.
Most definitely. Yeah. I have a friend who graduated from college last year. His name's Sam. He farms up in Nora Springs, Iowa, just north on the
interstate. Oh, I know Nora Springs, yes. Northeast Iowa, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so he actually is a first-year farmer, and he saw that land was too expensive for him as a young guy to start. And you know, when you think about the expense of young farmers, really, you're starting a business. And for any young individual, it's very expensive to start a business. And so he contacted some landowners in the area, and he was able to get some land to rent. And that's a beautiful model that we see, especially through Turva down the road, is helping young farmers connect with older landowners, people who might be looking for a new tenant, and creating that introduction, that foot in the door, so that they can get to know each other if they don't have those personal relationships vested in that community.
Wouldn't that be exciting to connect someone at the end of their farming career with somebody who aspires and has fire in the belly to start farming?
Yeah, that would be great. And those are the stories that I look forward to seeing and hearing.
See,
in the
future. That's the great thing about this. After you've been at this for a while, you're going to have stories to tell. And it's going to be stories that are exciting, that are motivational for people who are just trying to break into farming, that are comforting for a family who may not have children at all, or who may not have children who want to be involved in farming, who desperately need to have some input and some real data in making a choice about what comes next for the land.
That's so true. And everyone in agriculture, they want to do what's best for their land and for their animals and their production. And hopefully this website gives them a peace of mind, knowing that they can rest comfortably at night, that their land is in good hands.
Now give us your website so all can remember.
Wonderful. Well, it's turva.ag, www.terva.ag.
Turva. How did you come up with that name? Is that an acronym? Or?
It's actually two words put together, terrain and value. And so terrain with land. And so we put together land value and provide people the value of the land through our website.
Turva. I like that. Turva. Wow. Mm-hmm. And Judy, you must be proud of people like Stephen. This is why you're around, isn't it? It's great to see this happening.
Absolutely. Being around the energy that these students bring every day makes it just a fabulous job. And to be able to tell stories of this is how this – and I think of some of the roadblocks that Stephen's had, and to have him sit here today on the front page of the paper and actually running his business, it's just an extremely heartwarming, rewarding thing to be a part of.
Yeah, this is exactly why the Papa John Center, you know, exists. That's the kind of thing that you're hoping will happen with everybody. And so not everyone is successful, but to try. And even if you find out you're not an entrepreneur, that's new information too. You know? So some people select themselves out of that. But I really like the whole prospect of an entrepreneur, potential entrepreneur, facing a panel of people who are realists and highly experienced in the business community and know what it takes to make that. And they can be very helpful as a resource ongoing too. When the entrepreneur, that's the real strength of your program, that they're still a resource for that person as they build their business, as their idea becomes a reality, and as they progress toward that place where they're on their own. And so, boy, it sounds like, I would not refer to Stephen as a child prodigy, but he certainly is a big billboard for your program. It's just been delightful. And Stephen, I just hope that things really work out for you and you maintain your momentum. As a farm boy myself, and I had three brothers, and we actually sold our farmland, but I retained the acreage. Even though my career was in Des Moines, I came up because Dad and I, before he died, fixed up the farm. We painted these 100-year-old buildings. And so I kept the acreage plus 2 acres, and we sold to a neighbor. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that worked out.
Should have used Turba.
So it all worked out beautifully. I'm living on a farm that I love. And as a farm boy, it's a very important heritage for me. And every day I get up, and I walk out there, and that's where my dad began farming with horses in 1930. And when it comes to the land, I remember that line from Gone with the Wind when, you know, Scarlett's father says, "Oh, Scarlett, it's the land, it's the land. It's the only thing worth living for and fighting for and dying for because it's the only thing that lasts." That's farmland, and that's the business you're in. Mm-hmm. And so delightful to meet you today. We have Judy Isles and Stephen Brockes. That's a German name. And Turva is the website. And
it'll be up on our website.
Yes, all this stuff. You know, our programs are reachable on our website, all of our local talk shows. And so anyone can grab this show out of the cloud and say, I want to hear about Turva.
Sounds great.
This is KHOI Community Radio. And our next segment goes back to April 29th at the People's Climate March in Des Moines. On that rainy day, Tim Dwight provided a solar array to power our sound system, and he told a story. His remarks had to be very brief, less than 3 minutes, in order to give time for all the speakers at the event. But local talk reporter Greta Anderson followed up with him by phone to get the full story on how a star football player became a full-time solar power advocate. That's entrepreneurship, too, I think. She reached him in Northern California, where he spends the majority of his time.
I'm talking with Tim Dwight. Tim is a solar advocate of Iowa. Many people, especially those who lived in Iowa City, as I did during the mid-90s, know Tim as an all-star football player. You were a wide receiver?
I was.
You were a household name back then for me, even though I did not follow football that closely. Cyclone fans might not know that.
Nation knows me well.
The Cyclone Nation knows you well. Did you defeat them bad?
I always gave them a good show.
Okay.
After a while, you just got to accept things. And, you know, you want to get a performer to come into your house and he does those things, you just have to kind of enjoy it, right? We had another really good guy that had some good games against him, too. But, yeah, I always played hard against them. So they got my best.
And then you also did track. You picked up some medals there. Went on to play pro football for 10 years. And when I saw you at the People's Climate Rally, I was a little bit surprised. You're not that big a guy.
No, I'm not.
You said that after your football career was reaching its close, you went to Iraq.
I did. I had an opportunity to go on some USO trips to kind of build the morale in our troops. And, you know, when you're going into that type of situation, you know, you don't know really what to expect. You know, I have very little knowledge about our military. And, you know, we're very entwined in this world. And I think, you know, the American people really need to more understand that at a level because, you know, they go about their daily business and a lot of them don't live around bases and they don't see it every day. So it's like out of sight, out of mind. You know, I really wasn't into renewables at that time. I did have an opportunity to look at a solar company I put some small money into back in 08. And then my first trip to Iraq was 09. Because it kind of got me sparking because I saw this technology and you saw the growth happen in Europe. Some of these other, you know, island countries, and you're like, wow. And then you look at this technology, and you're like, okay, this could be fairly big. And I think a lot of people have known that for a long time. So I went to Iraq, and I knew a lot of it was about oil. It's about power over there. It's about territory. So I wanted to see it firsthand and see what our military goes through and the things that they have to accomplish over there. I mean, we had soldiers inside a makeshift outdoor mall that was like 7 stories tall that we visited, and it's inside Baghdad. And we literally like flew in inside the wire. We dropped these 2 Blackhawks right in there, jumped out, hustled in, and we toured this area where these folks were at for, you know, 7 months, didn't have showers, you know, because they would blow up all their showers and things. So you sit in these, you know, bunk beds in an 8-foot tall room and 3 bunks high. You know, this is what we put our service people through, you know, and I got to like thinking like, you know, this is all about energy. All this is about energy. I mean, energy runs the world, coal, natural gas, nuclear, oil, you know, and I finally got home. I was there for 5 days. You know, our service people go over there for 12 months and then they get a 2-week jump and then they have to come back and they have to go back into that, you know, and then they think they can just insert themselves into a natural way of life when there's so many things that they're going on over there for them, you know, and when you're fighting I mean, it's easy to go in there at the first point because people've got uniforms and you're, hey, this is our side, that's your side, right?
Right.
Well, imagine playing a football game where you have no idea who's who. You know, so psychologically that deals with you big time. You know, and you're always on jump. You're always, you know, like just feel the energy, you know, going over there. I mean, when that plane lifted out of Camp Burning over in Kuwait, I mean, the whole attitude changed. I mean, everybody walking on that plane knowing you're going into a war zone. I mean, your mind completely gets into like hyper mode and like intense. You know, I was playing football at a high level and I felt intense the whole time over there. And I was there for 5 days. So when I came back, I was like, you know, I'm gonna go back over there. You know, I really want to look. I really want to understand the costs of war, not just on a dollar amount, because flying those Blackhawks around, we took so many trips. I'm thinking, how much is this for the ratepayer? And that's just me shoveling around a celebrity, you know, let alone all the operations that are, you know, still going on today, as well as the height of the war back in like 2011, 2012, we're spending $12 billion a month, you know, all these operations and building these bases. And I mean, those guys had nothing when they went over there in 2003, we first invaded. You know, they had nothing. They had tents, 130 degrees. I went in July on the second trip. And I'm out at this base and they had this outdoor track. And I'm like, I'm going to go work out. It was 130 some degrees out. And I'm working on this track. I'm like, these people, you know, our service people got to wear these guns and they have all this equipment and all this stuff they got to wear. And, you know, they always got to be on jump. And it's just like, you know, so I want to make a difference. You know, so playing football in the NFL, you know, you do big things. So when I got retired, I was, you know, 32 and the solar, you know, company came up and I was like, you know, this little solar cell is going to change the world. I want to be a part of that.
Was this the same solar company you had invested a little bit in?
Yeah, so they were working on some things that have taken a while to develop because this industry is very difficult. I mean,
it was slow moving.
Well, yeah, I mean, I rolled right in the NFL, right? Well, how long has it took the NFL to get where it is today? You know, a long time. Like, look how many people are on the field during the Super Bowl at the coin toss. You go back to 1960, there's 4 people. You know, like a very small industry, right? So when I went to the NFL, it was already laid out. I mean, all those people did all the work. So I'm learning in a new industry, especially one that's very, you know, government oriented. I mean, it's not a free market. These folks have monopolies, so you have to break up monopolies. Utility companies, oil companies, you know, so it's been a very hard market to be in, like slow moving because of utilities, because of laws. I mean, you have to do everything through either a legislative process.
You're listening to an interview with former Hawkeye and professional football player Tim Dwight, who got involved in solar energy after witnessing the fiscal and human costs involved in securing fossil fuels in Iraq. The company he had invested in is based in Novato, California, north of San Francisco, and he has a home there. But he told Local Talk reporter Greta Anderson he does spend a good deal of time at the State House in Iowa advocating for policy that would advance the solar industry here.
I come back for a couple of weeks in the off season and the summers and stuff and family, but I'm there a lot now just because of legislative process. I kind of started this trade association group that's been up the Capitol since 2011 pushing for solar policy. You know, we've been up there now like 5 years, 6 years, trying to promote policy and open up the market to have islands really take advantage of this technology and to modernize our grid. So I think you learn when you're bringing a new technology into the market, and then you got to develop it. So it's been a real learning experience. You know, you wish you had some coaching. When you were in the NFL, you had these coaches and these older players that taught you stuff. And in our market, it's been this very small market, but it's changing. I mean, you're seeing a lot of solar companies now, and we're such a small portion of the energy matrix that it's pretty exciting seeing where we're going to go.
So what's the name of this company?
Integrated Power Corporation.
Integrated Power Corporation. And you make solar panels?
No, we are like the engineering portion of the market, as well as like services and support, and try to bring, you know, roofers, electrical contractors, builders, developers into the market space through, you know, photovoltaic. So, and we provide engineering, we provide kind of like production estimates. So we kind of help people kind of come to us, and we provide service like an architect.
And where are solar panels made?
Well, we had a partner named Suniva, which was an American manufacturer. It's out of Georgia Tech, and they've had some troubles in the market because people understand, like, the Chinese have really, they've been ahead of us for a long time. You know, what America needs to do is we need to innovate this module. I mean, this is like 1956, right? So can you imagine us talking on the phone right now? I got my Fitbit on me that tells me when I have a text message what my heart rate is, how far I've walked, how vertical I've gone, on a small little piece of device that's on my wrist. But, you know, a lot of innovation in that market. Watches have been around for a long time, and then you start bringing in all these other technologies. Well, finally, solar is becoming a point where now it's starting to change a little bit, bringing in storage inside the module. So Suniva is one of our partners. We've got a manufacturer out of the Midwest that does some modules for us for integrated power modules. And then, you know, if our customer wants to go low cost, we try to go Hanwha, which is like it's a Korean company that bought up Qcells, which is a German company. Those are European made. There's a couple other Europeans, and then, you know, we also can go Chinese, too, because there's a couple good Chinese suppliers out there. I mean, they're doing, like, 3 to 4 gigawatts of production, which is massive compared to, you know, like, Suniva. They were, like, 700 megawatts. You know, that's 700 million watts. Some of these Chinese companies, like Trina, you know, there's 3 to 4 gigawatts, 3 to 4 billion watts. So they are producing 4 times the amount of modules you are, which means they're buying 4 times the amount of raw materials, which their costs are probably quite a bit cheaper. Price per unit goes way down. The solar is going to be so inexpensive. I mean, the cost today, it's amazing. We're 1% of the whole market, and, you know, we are way down in, like, you know, 40 cents a watt range. I came in the markets 5 years ago, and we were at $4 a watt for the module. $4, and we're down to 50 cents now, or 40 cents. And we're still 1% of the full market. So imagine what our costs are going to be when we're 10% of the market. So it's pretty exciting to see. But yeah, so, you know, when in the future, when you have this much energy in the grid, you're powering out to the grid, you're storing at the same time, you're powering vehicles. So if anything ever goes down, it's going to be like one little building's going to go down because everything else is going to have storage. You have to look at assets, okay? I mean, like a football team. Tim Dwight was fast. That's an asset. He could catch. That was an asset. All right, so we'll put him in the slot. We'll put him outside. He can return punts. Oh, he can catch punts. There's an asset, all right? So I had all these assets. Well, solar, when you look at the grid structure, you got to look at all these different assets and what they do to the grid. And you got to value that asset. So, you know, when you have one company that's had the monopoly, they're not going to value your asset unless they're forced to value it.
Right.
And that was some of the things that we wanted to do with this program that Mid-American and Alliant were going to build to the IUB. We wanted them to kind of value these assets. See, the grid right now is like there's no data points really on the grid. Now, you come to California, like I'm in right now, and they've had smart metering going on in San Diego Gas and Electric for the last 4 or 5 years, and now they're starting to grab all this data. But once you have data on the patient, which is the grid, then you can start to do things with the grid and the patient that, you know, makes it better, right? And so that's modernization. And now, see, people don't understand, like, the grid is 100 years old. It's inefficient, it's so expensive, and it's so pollutive. But you don't see it because it takes place way out in the middle of nowhere.
And your emphasis with the Iowa Utilities Board is to modernize the grid so that data can be collected?
Yeah, build programs where we're modernizing things and taking data on what's really happening real time. You know, because utilities haven't been like that. They kind of build things on mass levels, right? So they look at the weather and they say, okay, it's this for the next week. Okay, what was it like that last year? What was it like 5 years ago? What was it like this? And then they try to figure out, all right, we need this much energy. 2 scoops of coal, it's out of the ground, you throw it in the fire, and you're good to go. Bigger level, like MISO, those guys are looking at stuff real time. But I'm talking about the distributed level. I'm talking all the way down to someone's, like, house. You know, we're not even close to being there yet. And that's being efficient, and that's modernizing the grid. So imagine doing business in a real-time data-driven industry. I mean, if you don't have the real-time data, you're going to lose. But it's a monopoly, so they don't have to compete. You know, they don't have to do these efficiency measures because they've had no competition to change the market. But now that's changing because solar is a generator, and it's bringing more people into the marketplace.
This is fascinating stuff, Tim. And I think you've really opened our eyes to a lot of the complexities of the solar industry. And, you know,
and this is coming from a football player, right? Like,
What did you study in college?
Still learning.
What did you study in college?
I was like a sports management. I thought I was going to be an agent after I could play or run track or something. I didn't think I was going to play that long in the NFL, you know. I wanted to fight for that long. And as I got better and I learned my trade, I was like, all right, I think I can play a little longer. But I got really lucky with a lot of great teams and a lot of great players. I mean, playing with Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Doug Flutie, pretty awesome. A little small Iowa kid, coming out of there. Uh-huh. Little I know, I'd be rubbing elbows with these guys in meeting rooms and learning great things from them. So I try to take a lot of that into this industry and really looked at, it's really hard. It's hard because you got to look at all these different levels. And you have to know all these different dynamics about it. And then you've got this big monopoly that, can really outpower you, all these different ways, whether it's through lobbyists or advertising or, but that's like one of the motivating factors for me is when I was returning punts and kicks, I was the smallest guy in the field, but man, when I took one 90 some yards in that Super Bowl, I mean, it was like, boom, it's like, it doesn't matter how small you are or whatever. If you're motivated and excited and you're, wanting to do some big things, you kind of look for that. And, I tell people, I said, everything I've done in my life has got me ready for this industry because it's, like I said, it's not moving as fast as you're used to because it's just a new industry and it's a lot of education out there that needs to happen and policy too, a lot of uncertainty. And that's really hard to build, industries on when your type industry can move and be terminated, in 6 months or a year.
You've really brought the cheerleader out in me. So I just want to say go solar.
Go solar. All right. Well, Greta, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to, be on your show. Educate Iowans, and people need to know about solar. They need to dive in. And now people are starting to understand more about climate change. Solar is one of the biggest answers to that. Solar is going to change the world, and it's changing the world. We just need to get more people involved, more people excited about it. I look at it like World War II, and when the Nazis were taking everything over there in Europe, we had to industrialize really fast. Women had to go to work, and the men had to go there and fight. This is what we need to do, and mobilize like we did back then, now for what we're fighting, against this climate that's rapidly changing on us. And the great thing is going to come out of that: modernization, job growth, building new innovations in technology that's decades old, like the power plants, really, really old technology, the combustion engine. You got all these cool things going on electronically in your car. The core purpose of that vehicle still is a combustion engine, and it's like 20% efficient. Very inefficient technology.
Tim, the next time you're in Iowa, will you make an appointment with the library to do a presentation here in Ames? We'd love to hear this in person.
Well, I you always got my best when I was in Ames.
That's like right. That. Come back and tell us all about it.
All right, Greta. Have a great week.
You too.
Well, that was Tim Dwight, not only an entrepreneurial guy in solar energy, but, here I am in Ames, Iowa, but I'm a Hawkeye fan. Although I root for both Cyclones and the Hawkeyes, unless they're playing together, then I have to be a Hawkeye fan. But I vividly remember Tim Dwight's career. He was fast. He was a good man with hands, catching passes, punt return. And what I remember about Tim was his unfailing optimism and tendency to smile a lot. And, of course, as you can see by the interview, very, very competent, intelligent, and articulate. So he is one of my favorite Hawkeyes because he was not only great football player, but a positive influence, and it's so nice to see him in the vanguard of something positive in the energy world.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's good to have you around to bring us back to the reality of football when we're off in solar energy. This is KHOI Community Radio, and my co-host Paul Wearson and I have been together so far, but I'm going to close out this program with a short road trip that Fritz and I took last Saturday to the Iowa Arboretum and Expressions Gallery in Slater. At the Arboretum, we saw a few of the early blooming iris that will be among the 400 bearded iris on display during the American Iris Society 2017 convention in Des Moines from May 23rd to 27th, May 19th and 20th, and next weekend, May 27th and 28th, should be prime viewing for hundreds of colorful flowers. Arboretum grounds are open every day, year-round, from sunrise to sunset.
Well, Susan, what was going on at the Expressions Gallery in Slater?
I went there because I saw articles in the Tri-County Times and the Ames Tribune about this show. I thought a new gallery in Slater was something to visit, and I was intrigued by reading that it was the Nasty Women show. When I talked with Sherry Teja, I discovered that Expressions is a different kind of gallery beyond the Nasty Women. Why don't you tell us about your current exhibit?
It's called The Nasty Women Show. The title, of course, is a result of Donald Trump's references to women in general. So I've done some sculptures of what I consider notable women in the past, especially Iowans. Belle Mansfield was the first woman ever credentialed as an attorney, and she was from here in Iowa, southeastern Iowa, Mount Pleasant, I believe. And I've done a small sculpture of her. Of course, when Hillary was nominated by the Democrats and last summer, I started a sculpture of her and as the nominee, and anticipating that I'd do a bust of her as a president, first woman president. But anyway, the show, the Nasty Women show, includes that sculpture of her. It's rather small, but full figure of her. And then also some other important women that I think most of us don't know anything about. Victoria Woodhull was the first woman who ever ran for president in the United States in 1872. She was nominated by a progressive party. They nominated her as the presidential candidate. Frederick Douglass was the vice presidential candidate for that progressive party. He didn't take it seriously. He actually went out on the stump for Ulysses Grant. But Victoria actually traveled around and campaigned. She didn't get any electoral votes, but she did get votes. They didn't keep track very well. And there was maligning her, of course, for being a woman and running for president. And women didn't, of course, have the right to vote until 1920. I think she would have turned 35 after having been elected, too. So there was that minor. Also in the show is Jeanette Rankin. She was the first woman who was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. She actually was elected in 1916, prior to women having the vote, although there were 10 states in the West women could vote in, and she was instrumental in, as a suffragist for lobbying Montana to be one of those 10, and that's where she was elected from. At the time, they had at-large vote, and I believe they had two U.S. representatives, and so she was one of the two at-large U.S. representatives from Montana. She was definitely a peace activist as well as a suffragist. At the time that she was elected to the Congress the first time, she was a Republican, and the Republican Party was a progressive party still at that point in time. And she was one of about 50 or so U.S. Congress people who voted against going to World War I. And that was actually a major contributing factor for her losing re-election in Montana for a second term. So she only served one term at that time. Part of the strategy to make sure she wasn't reelected was to develop districts for congressional districts in Montana as opposed to having them voted at large. And as a result of redistricting, she was not elected to a second term. Over the next several decades, she was a very prominent peace activist and member of a number of different organizations, including the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She still had a residence in Montana as well as Georgia, but spent a lot of time in both places. And then when FDR was president, she was elected to Congress again from Montana, and again only served one term, and as a result of her being the lone vote not to enter World War II. So very active throughout her entire life. A lot of people even today recognize her name, if they're old enough, to remember her in the 1960s. She was a big anti-war demonstrator, and she led a 5,000-person march on Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact. Very proud to call her part of my Nasty Women show. All of my pieces at this point in time in this show are in progress, and some are rougher than others, but by the end of June, they'll all be all five of them will be finished.
So if people missed your opening in August, then they can come and see the completed show from now on, I guess.
Well, one of the things I like about having my own gallery is that I can have pieces in progress rather than just having finished pieces. Bronze is very expensive, and you know, a lot of people, like including myself at this point in time, can't afford to have you know, bronze pieces just laying around the gallery, you know. So that's one of the benefits, like I say, of having my own gallery is I can have pieces in progress. And people actually like to see, well, what do you use? I like clay and wax to do my original pieces. Well, I have Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, the first woman who became a Supreme Court justice. Also, Hillary, of course, our Democratic nominee. And then I have another sculpture of the first woman who became a senator. She was from Georgia and was the spouse of a U.S. House member. And there was an open seat in the Senate. She had been instrumental in running all of his campaigns and was a big-time mover and shaker in the political world in Georgia. And so the governor at that time was planning to run for the Senate, so he appointed her as the potential interim senator from Georgia. He actually lost the election, and the gentleman that won the election said, no, go ahead and have her be the senator, basically for a day. You know, I'm not sure what all of his rationale was, but it was definitely part of the political bargaining at the time for her to be senator for a day.
When was this?
1922, November 1922. Then I've also got plans to do rough out a sculpture of the first woman who was elected to the Senate. Hattie Caraway was her name, and she was from Arkansas. Huey Long in Louisiana was a big backer of hers and instrumental in her becoming elected, but she was the first woman elected to the Senate, and she served, I believe, two terms, and then was very well respected for the work that she did and ended up being a bureaucrat, actually, for the rest of her career.
It's quite interesting that several of these women are from the South. Because you don't really think about women in politics in the South.
No, not at all. And they were not Democrats in the way we think of Democrats today either. And then, like I mentioned before, Jeanette Rankin wasn't the type of Republican that we think of today either, an elected official. So the parties have changed quite a bit over the years in terms of political and philosophical bent. And I think it's good for us to remember that the parties don't have stagnant policies or philosophies, that over time it's very common for things to change and organizations to change.
And nasty women have a part in it.
Absolutely, nasty women have a part in it.
Well, that was Sherry Teja in Expressions Gallery in Slater, which is full of works in progress. It's an interesting concept for a gallery. This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. We spoke with Judy Iles and Stephen Brockshus from the Papa John Center for Entrepreneurship, Tim Dwight, advocate from the solar industry, and Sherry Teja, owner of Expressions Gallery in Slater.
Now, Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 and at noon today. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Now that's khoifm.org is our website, and you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
And Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to join the team as a reporter, just contact us at 515-292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.